I believe that at the end of the hour, we just mentioned our next number, D, the Council of Conscience. And under that number, one would be the calling of the Council. The Council of Conscience was from 1414 to 1418. It was about 3.5 years that it was in session. This is one of the most important of the all of the ecumenical councils, so-called, or the general council. The most important of them are, of course, the first four, which are supreme in importance. And then I think the next most important after those, chronologically, would probably be this Council of Conscience. And then the Council of Trent, and these last two Vatican councils. Those would be the ones of particular interest to us. There were a number in between, but they dealt to a very large extent with temporary matters, while most of these dealt with matters of long-lasting significance. And so, number one, the calling of the council. As you know, the situation at this time was one which was very unsatisfactory. The English had recognized one pope, the French another one. Italy was divided between these two men who claimed to be pope. And in 1409 at the Council of Pisa, many of the cardinals of each of the two popes had come together, and they'd had a great council meeting at Pisa, and the council had deposed both popes. The only trouble was the popes didn't recognize that the council deposed them. But the council declared these two popes to be deposed and chose another one. And the result was that from 1409 to 1414, there were three popes. And this, of course, made the situation even worse. And so all through Europe, there were people who were saying the important thing should not be what a pope thinks, but what a council thinks. And this movement came to be called the conciliar movement. That is, the movement for thinking that a council is the supreme authority, the conciliar movement. Great leaders in the university took this position. The leaders of the University of Paris, for instance, took it very strongly. The popes were declaring excommunications against each other, calling each other all kinds of names, accusing them of schism, of heresy, of everything else, and many of the leaders were saying the real authority is a council which is properly called and which represents all of Christendom. And actually, the having of a council at this time was a very great achievement when you realize that this was right in the middle of one of the great wars between England and France, and that the Battle of Agincourt, the great victory that the English secured over France, which gave them control of perhaps two-thirds of the country, and looked for a time as if they would get all of France into their hands, that occurred shortly after the Council of Conscience started. And yet the representatives of France and the representatives of England were present during this time in the Council of Conscience, trying to take part in rearranging the affairs of the Church in order to make a tremendous improvement. Well, now, we will, under a second head, after a few minutes, we will talk a little about the purposes of the council, but now to speak of the matter that many realized the need of a council, but the problem was how to call such a council. If a council is the supreme authority, you can't just get a group of people together any time and say, we're a council. You have to have it definitely understood that this is a council that represents all of Christendom. And who has a right to call such a council? Well, it seemed most logical to think that since for many years the Pope had been recognized as at least the executive head of Christendom, and many had considered him as the absolute monarch of the religious world, that under these circumstances, the way to have a council that would be recognized as having authority would be to have it called by a Pope. And here were these three men who were claimed to be popes. Now, most people who wanted to heal the schism felt that it would be very difficult to take one of these three men and continue him as pope. because he was, all three had attacked each other so violently that you could not very well get everyone to unite behind one of them. The best thing to do was to get rid of all three. But in order to call such a council, if you could get the authority of one of them, that would be a tremendous help in getting one started. The man who was perhaps most active in getting the council started, and who perhaps did more than any other one man to carry the council through and get its things in such a way that it would accomplish a number of things, was a young emperor, Sigismund, the German emperor. You remember that a few centuries before, when the papacy had become the football of rival petty factions in Rome, and very wicked and inferior men had been put into the position by one of these factions after another. It was the German emperors who had rescued the papacy from that situation, who had gotten rid of the degenerates who were in the position and had put in men of higher character. Well, again, at this time, it was the German emperor who rescued the papacy, although that is not nearly so widely recognized as in the earlier case, because his authority was largely overshadowed by the authority of the Council of Constance. But it was his influence and his activity that got the council into being, and that had much to do with its continuing until at least one of its purposes, well, perhaps two of its purposes, had been accomplished. So this man's name was Sigismund, S-I-G-I-S-M-U-N-D. And Sigismund managed to prevail on one of the three popes to call the council and to declare that he was ready to officiate at the council and that he was ready to carry out what it should decide. Now, this was a difficult thing to do, to persuade John the 23rd to do this. John the 23rd was the man who had been elected by the cardinals of the new Pisa Pope when this man, Alexander, had died. They had elected him, one out of their number, to be the next pope. And people often wonder now why they ever elected him, because he was about as unworthy of being a pope as any man who ever occupied the papal position. And yet, as you look at the situation, it's not so difficult to see why they did, because he was undoubtedly the most able man among this group of cardinals who were supporting the Pisa Pope. He was the most able man among them. He was a skillful man, a strong man, very brutal in many ways, very unscrupulous in many ways, a man who had been a pirate as a young man, but who had carried through his objectives in life quite effectively. And he towered as to ability above any other of the cardinals in this little group of cardinals that had two other groups opposing them, and rather naturally they selected him and made him their pope. And in fact, during these few years before the council, he had moved very vigorously against the Hussites in Bohemia and had sent his representatives to declare John Huss to be a heretic and call on the Czechs to oppose him, and had persuaded many of the ecclesiastical leaders there to stand with him. And this, of course, had resulted in John Huss's investigating the question, what is the real authority of the Pope, and declaring that a Pope has no authority except what he deserves by virtue of real spiritual character, and that if he is a sinful man, he has no right to any authority whatever. And it was very easy then to point to John 23rd as an example of the kind of Pope who should not have any authority whatever. Well, Sigismund worked to get John 23rd to agree to this and succeeded, although John 23rd hesitated greatly. He had succeeded in getting most of Italy into his power, and for a couple of years he had had his headquarters in Rome and had been quite successful. Gregory, the remaining pope of the line from Urban VI, the so-called Roman line, had comparatively few people who were supporting him anymore. But then, shortly before the Council of Constance, there had been an uprising against John 23rd. He'd been driven out of Rome. And so he was in a rather precarious situation And he was hopeful that maybe the council here would carry on what they'd done at Pisa and would depose the other two popes and then would declare him to be the rightful pope. So he agreed to come to Constance. But as he entered the city and as he saw the great numbers of people who had gathered, a little town of 5,000 people in which hundreds of thousands of people came during the time of the council. Tremendous numbers of people and great numbers of very prominent leaders from all over Europe. And it was a city which, as you see, was as you'd enter, you'd see these great numbers of people and you just wondered what you were getting into. And they say that John turns to somebody and he says, this is what they do when they try to catch foxes. They try to get them into a hole where they can easily seize them. And he was rather afraid of what would come. But he came before the council and declared his willingness to abdicate as soon as the other two popes would. And each of them had been declaring this for years. Each of them would abdicate as soon as the others would. But he not only declared it, he took a vow before the whole council that he would do so. And the representatives were there from all over Europe, and the council proceeded, but most of them didn't show great respect toward John the 23rd, for whom they had practically no respect as a man. And the result of this struggle among the three popes, and previously among the two, led more and more of them to think a council should decide what is right for the church and should establish the line of activity and should meet frequently in order to determine new problems as they come up. And there would be need of an executive officer, but he would only be somebody to carry out the desires of the council. So that the council was called, all these people came together, John the 23rd declared that it was an ecumenical council to represent all of Christendom, and they proceeded to undertake to carry out the problems, to deal with the problems that were before them. Now, number two, we'll call the organization of the council. One was the calling of the council. Two was the organization of the council. And there had been councils before at which nominally every bishop had a vote, but they were in Italy, and most of the Italian bishops could get there easily, while bishops from other countries couldn't come and stay for months very well. And so the Italian bishop would be in a majority. And it was very specially desired by the men from France and other countries that the Italian bishop should not have an absolute majority and have control of the council. And so after considerable discussion, they decided that at this council, instead of every bishop who was present having a vote, the vote should be by nation. And at first they thought that there were nations that they considered to be there. There was the Italian for one, and there was the French for another, and then there was the German, and they considered England as part of the German nation. And so at first there were these three nations, but although not a great many men had come all the way from England, they recognized the importance of the English influence and the ability of some of the men who were present and decided to make England a fourth nation. So they had four nations when the council began. And they decided that each nation should have an equal vote. So these four nations met separately. And they had the meetings of the representatives of each of the four nations. And in these meetings, the cardinals would vote, the bishops would vote, abbots would vote, and also professors in the university would vote. It was quite a large group in most of these nations. It tried to include all of those present from that nation who would be people of considerable standing or training or background. And then each of the nations would vote separately, and when the majority of the nations agreed on something, then they would have a big general meeting at which they would have a general recognition of that which had been voted by the majority of the nation. They tried to get the Spanish to come too, but as you know, one of the three popes was a Spaniard. He was the successor of the Avignon Pope, The French had lost much of their enthusiasm for the Avignon Pope when the second of them to be elected after the schism was a Spaniard. But the Spanish were very proud to have one of the popes be a Spaniard, and they were backing him up, and he did not give him his support to the council at all. And so the Spaniards did not come into the council until after it had been underway some years. But when finally the Spaniards decided that as a whole they would support the council, then they were recognized as a fifth nation and given an equal vote with the others. So this voting was by nation in this way, with the English for the first time being given recognition as a separate nation, not part of the Germanic nation. Representatives from Scandinavia were put in with the German nation in the voting. Now this was the organization of the council. Now three, the purposes of the council. The purposes of the council. Now the purpose which was affected the greatest number of people, perhaps was the best recognized universally as a need for such a council, but yet in a way not the most pressing, the least pressing in a way, and yet the most important, was the need for reform of the church. And so we will call small a here, the purpose of the council was to reform the church. Everybody recognized that abuses had come in. And many people had been declaring for a century or two that the church needed reform in head and in members. Now, the type of abuses which most people had in mind were the abuses that came from the fact that the church had acquired so much property in the course of the centuries as people left legacy to the church, and land was given to it, and monarchs gave it property, and the church had acquired so much wealth that positions in the church were positions of tremendous prestige, that is a high position, tremendous prestige, tremendous opportunities for wealth and for personal gratification. And so from the Pope on down, these positions in the church, many of them had become simply political plums. And, of course, the monarchs and the nobility often were seeking these plums for those of their sons who could not inherit their own position, for their younger sons. And so there was had been struggle for years as to who would have these positions which received these large incomes. And from this, there had come the abuse that they called simony, based on the statement in the Acts where Simon offered the apostles money if they would give him the power to give the Holy Spirit to whom he chose. They called it simony when somebody would sell a church office. And simony was very widespread. You remember that a few centuries before this, there occurred what Pharaoh calls the greatest simony in the history of Christendom, when the papal office was sold, and when a good man, wanting to rescue the papacy from its terrible degradation, paid a tremendous sum of money in order to receive the papacy. And in that particular case, the man then declared that he had been a sinner in doing it and was unqualified to continue, but it helped in rescuing it from the degradation into which it had fallen. Well, the popes had been, many of them, and so had the bishops and other officers, of selling position in the church. Some not usually expressed quite that way, but they would say, you give me the income for the first year, or you give me half the income for the first 5 years, or something like that. And often this didn't take the position, didn't seem like simply selling the office so much as receiving a disqualification for it, as when a man already had an important position and he won another one. And this could only be done with a special dispensation. And the Pope would say, in order to give this dispensation, I would have to require you to pay so much money. So this thing of charging money for things like this was a very great abuse. And along with that went, very naturally, what they called pluralism. Pluralism was when one man held several positions. And sometimes a man would hold as many as a dozen important church positions. And he'd receive the income from all of them and not do the work of any of them. Pluralism was very widespread and continues to be right up to this, till the Reformation was well underway. Pluralism, and naturally, along with pluralism, went absenteeism. That is, a man would have a position. He would be nominally the bishop of a certain area, responsible to oversee the work of the church in that area, and he'd never go near it. Inferior men, perhaps with no training or qualifications, whatever, would be paid a small sum of money to carry on the some of the work and to raise the money and send it into him. So absenteeism. And then nepotism. N-E-P-O-T-I-S-M was a very common abuse. That comes from the Latin word nepot, which means a nephew. And this is because the church officers were supposed not to have families. They were not supposed to be married, therefore they would not have sons, but they would give positions often to their nephews, or to people they called their nephews. And so the giving of a position to a relative, it seemed to be called nepotism. And the term is still used often in that sense, but in other connections. I heard, for instance, somebody telling about a Hollywood movie firm where they said there was a case of nepotism. They said that the president of the company had two cousins who were hired at a high sum on the payroll of the company, and one sat at one side of the building and the other sat at the other. And somebody asked what they were supposed to do, and they said, well, the one on this side watches to see if, in case there should be a landslide, so he could give us warning. And the one on the other side watches in case there should be a tidal wave. And that they called nepotism, giving a man a position where he had very little to do, but he received a high salary. Of course, the term nepotism is thus often used in various senses for putting people in as relatives who have no other special qualification for a position. Of course, along with this, naturally, the greater part of the regular work of the church was being done by people of little qualification, people who often could not read and write, who often knew practically nothing about the Bible. There were, of course, along with this, many very worthy men, often very inconspicuous, but often doing a very fine task of presenting the gospel, presenting the words of Christ, and doing good things. And there were people in monasteries here and there, people like the Brothers of the Common Light, who wrote those works that Luther so praised later, on their devotion to Christ and the attempting to follow him in all things. There were these people, but most of them were not particularly conspicuous, but they were to be found, some of them, all over Europe. The gospel was present and was being blessed in a small way, but in all areas, here and there, there was some true knowledge of the gospel. But in the church, especially in the visible features of the church, there was so much of abuse and corruption and wickedness that everybody recognized, nobody questioned, that there was a great need to reform the church. And it was desired that the Council of Constance should reform the church. And many of the people there present felt that was the first duty of the council. Now there were, along with that, I'll mention second the matter of the problem of heresy. Call it the problem of heresy. Now this was a problem, the problem of heresy, because the idea had become established all through Europe that there was theoretically one empire with one secular ruler maintaining order and one church. And with one church, a united church, there might be differences of opinion on various matters, but there should be agreement at least on the main theme. And when they found that Wycliffe's poor priests were going about in England reading the Word of God and denouncing doctrines which were then had been accepted by all the leadership of the church in all the different countries, denying transubstantiation, for instance, many people who were not particularly interested in the doctrinal problems felt that here was a threat of dividing the church up into little groups instead of having one unified church, and that something should be done about it. And this had spread to Czechoslovakia. And John Huss had probably the majority of the people of Czechoslovakia loved the man and loved his preaching, his wonderful sermon, his great presentation that he had, his loyalty to the scriptures, his many fine godly qualities. And when Huss pointed to a wicked pope like John 23rd and said, No one has any authority over Christ's people who has a wicked character like that. It struck a responsive chord in people's hearts. And others who felt it was tremendously important there should be unity felt these problems should be settled by a general council which would decide what the truth is, and then would either people would either accept it or something vigorous would be done about it to prevent their dividing the church by spreading ideas contrary to what the group as a whole felt to be true. And so the problem of heresy with the Wycliffeite movement in England and the Hussite movement in Bohemia was a matter that they felt it was very vital that they should do something about. And then the third was the most immediate problem of all. That was the healing, they called it the healing of the schism. The healing of the schism. If they desire to have a unified church, nothing was more harmful to the idea of a unified church than the fact of having three men, each of whom claimed to be the head of the church, each of whom had his group of cardinals, and each of whom was recognized by a considerable number of secular authorities as the head of the church, and each of whom declared the others to be heretics and schismatics and wicked people to whom no one should give allegiance. This was the situation which made the immediate pressing necessity of doing something about the situation. And so this was the one thing they had to settle for sure, and this is the one thing they succeeded in settling, was the schism. But that occupied them off and on the whole 3.5 years that they were in session to get this solved. I don't think I'll speak quite immediately about how they solved the schism, but we'll deal with how they settled the second of these, or tried to solve it. They didn't really solve it, but what they did about the second, the problem of heresy. And so we will make number four then. Three was the purposes of the council, and we will make number four the council's actions regarding heresy. The council's actions regarding heresy. Very soon after the council was started, they sent an invitation to John Hutt to come to the council. And this invitation that was sent naturally, John Hutt wouldn't be expected to come and put himself in their power. But to try to persuade him to do so, the Emperor Sigismund, who was very anxious that all three of these problems be solved, gave Hutt a safe conduct. And so this safe conduct declared that all officials of the empire everywhere were ordered to give free passage to John Hutt during a certain period of time to come to the council and to be heard there and to express his views there and to return safely to his home, and declared that the empire would consider as traitors and enemies anyone who would interfere with this man's freedom during this stated period of time. And with this safe counsel in his hand, Hutt was persuaded to come to the council. Now there were friends who urged him not to come. Many a noble in Czechoslovakia said, "I have a strong castle here. You don't know what that council is going to do, but I have a strong castle here and a number of retainers. You come and stay with me here in the castle, and no matter what they do, you will be perfectly safe. I can protect you here against any force that is at all likely would ever be sent against you." But Hutt was very, very anxious that his views should be presented to the council. And Hutt, he put confidence in the elector's safe conduct to some extent, and also confidence in his own ability as an orator. He had moved great multitudes, and he had had great influence with individuals who had been hostile to him at first, and then had heard him speak and present his teaching, and had turned to become strong supporters of it. And he felt that if he could speak before the council and could present the facts before the council and give them the scriptural evidence, that they would undoubtedly decide to carry out their reforms along the lines that he felt were scriptural teaching. And so Hus went to the council.
Well, now, very soon, I'm not sure before Hus got to the council or whether it was after he was already there,
that the council, I think it was after he was there, I think the chronology was that soon after he was there, they arrested him, and they put him in a disagreeable dungeon. And his friends protested very vigorously, and Sigismund became very angry and protested. But the council said that a promise given to a heretic has no binding force on England, and therefore that his promise of safe conduct did not deserve any respect. Sigismund went on for a time, insisting that they should release Hus in accordance with the safe conduct he had given him, but Sigismund probably was influenced by the fact that he was so anxious to get the papal schism remedied. And when he found that the leaders of the council were so dead set against his idea of respecting his safe conduct, and they said, we recognize that this man is a wicked heretic who deserves death, why should your individual promise overcome our conviction on these matters? He saw that if he insisted, or if he used force to deliver Hus, that probably the council would break up, and the papal schism would go on, and he felt that more good would be accomplished by forgetting about Hus and keeping the council going. And we don't know what all was in Sigismund's mind. There are those who are extremely critical of him for his allowing them to keep Hus. There are others who try to excuse him on the basis of these various considerations. Any man in a position such as his often has tough problems to solve, where harm is going to come whatever you decide. But if a person is really to stand for the Lord, he certainly has to have certain principles that he will not go back on, no matter what the result might be. At any rate, Sigismund, there's good reason to think that he was very much ashamed of the fact that he did go back on his safe conduct. And yet, this was an example that was remembered, and the Hussites talked about it incessantly. Who can trust an imperial safe conduct when, with the most binding of safe conduct, Hus can be seized this way and thrown into the dungeon and treated the way he was? And this was one of the things that was before Martin Luther a century later, when the emperor offered him a safe conduct. And as a matter of fact, Charles V carried out his safe conduct and allowed Luther, after he appeared before the Diet, to go back home without seizing him then. But they say that toward the end of Charles's life, one of his great regrets was that when he had Luther right in his power there, he let him go back. And so you can imagine what this effect has had on Luther's mind at that time to see what had been done to Hus now. Of course, Hus was spoken of as a wicked heretic all through Europe, aside from Bohemia, so much that the young monks like Luther simply took for granted he was. But one time, as a young monk, Luther picked up in the library a copy of some of Hus's sermons. And reading into it, he expressed amazement that a heretic could write such beautiful gospel presentations as he found in it. And later, of course, Luther came to feel that Hus was absolutely right. They felt that way before the time came when he went before the emperor. But Hus then was seized and put in prison, and he was kept there for weeks. And it ran into months, in fact, many months, with occasionally being brought out for a brief session. And in these sessions, they simply asked him a question. They said, are these your writings? Did you write this book? Are you ready to recant this? Here is this statement in the book. Did you say this? Do you still hold to this? Are you ready to turn back on this, or do you still stand by it? No chance to use his eloquence and to try to move people with the presentation of arguments. During this time, I believe it was, while he was there, that the council took another action. They took an action maintaining the decision John 23rd had made the year before in Rome to condemn John Wycliffe and all his work. And, of course, John Wycliffe had died 30 years before this. But the action that had been taken by various local councils and by John 23rd's group the year before, was now affirmed by the council that certain statements drawn from Wycliffe's writing, and Wycliffe was much more forthright in his attack on the superstitious doctrines than Huss was. Huss perhaps put more direct emphasis on the gospel than even Wycliffe did. More constant presentation of the meaning of the gospel for people's lives and of the wrong of attributing authority to men with wicked lives. While Wycliffe surveyed the whole field of theology and attacked the superstitions, and particularly the superstition of the mass, in very strong, clear ways. And so it was easy for them to draw statements from Wycliffe's writings which were contrary to the actions of previous councils and to the statements of many popes. And they declared that Wycliffe was a heretic, that his teachings were wicked, that no one should be allowed to support these teachings, and that his body should be dug up, taken away from consecrated ground, and burned, and the ashes thrown into the river. It was 10 years before this was carried out. But 10 years later, in England, one of the bishops had Wycliffe's body dug up, burned, and the ashes thrown into the river. And as somebody described it later, the ashes went into this little stream, from that into the bigger river, and from that out into the ocean and spread over the world. But I don't think they ever would have, if it were not for what Martin Luther did later. Because the terrible persecution in England against the followers of Wycliffe almost completely rooted them out before the time of the Reformation. But Huss knew what they had done to Wycliffe. And then the council declared that Huss should be burnt for his heresy. And so they took Huss out a little distance from the town to a place across the river there, and they piled up the wood all around him, and there they burned him at the stake. And then there was a follower of John Huss named Jerome of Prague. And Jerome of Prague had been carrying on Huss's teaching, and one thing that Jerome laid great stress on was the fact that Huss was not given a fair chance to present his views. And Jerome declared that it was wicked going back on the safe conduct for Huss. It was wicked burning him at the stake, but it was especially wicked that they did it without giving him any fair chance to present his views. And so they got word to Jerome, and they said, if you will come, we will give you full opportunity to present your view. And Jerome was a great Christian and a good thinker, but he was not the speaker at all that Huss was. And Jerome took advantage of the opportunity. And so Jerome, the next year, came to Constance. And he was seized, as Huss had been. And he was brought before the council, but he was given more opportunity to speak than had been given to Huss. And then Jerome was declared guilty, and he was taken out to the very spot where Huss had suffered. And there they say that it took much more time for the flame to put an end to his misery than it had with Huss. But he sang the Easter hymn, Hail Festal Day. His ashes were thrown into the Rhine, and many learned people wept, for they said he was almost more learned than Huss had been. And the council joined his name with those of Wycliffe and Huss as leaders of the heresy. But it's interesting that at the council there was a man who was typical of a new sort of man that was developing in Italy. Men following to some extent in the footsteps of Petrarch and of Boccaccio. That is to say, men who were interested in learning, they were interested in wit, they were interested in classic writing, interested in clever ways of putting things, and not particularly interested in any deep problems. They were quite content to let the church speak and follow as the church led, so long as they could have a chance to do their studying and their clever writing and live their lives as they felt like and tell their witty and clever but often very obscene jokes. Well, one man who was particularly typical of this type is a man called Poggio.
Poggio, I forget his last name, Broccolini or something like that, but he's generally just called by his first name, Poggio, P-O-G-G-I-O. Yes, here's his name, Bracciolini, Poggio Bracciolini, B-R-A-C-C-I-O-L-I-N-I. And he sent a letter to a friend telling about Jerome's defense of itself. And it's most interesting for the picture it gives of Jerome and also for the picture it gives of Poggio, who was typical of a class of people that was developing in Italy and that was to become very prominent during the coming decades. And now here is a translation of this letter that Poggio wrote to his friend. He said, speaking of Jerome's address in the cathedral, he said, "It is wonderful to see with what words, with what eloquence, with what argument, with what countenance, and with what composure Jerome replied to his adversaries, and how fairly he put his case. He advanced nothing unworthy of a good man, as though he felt confident, as he also publicly asserted, that no just reason could be found for his death. Many persons he touched with humor, many with satire, many very often he caused to laugh in spite of the sad affair, jesting at their reproaches. He took them back to Socrates, unjustly condemned by his fellow citizens. Then he mentioned the captivity of Plato, the flight of Anaxagoras, the torture of Zeno. Then he passed to Hebrew examples, afterwards coming down to John the Baptist and then the Savior. He showed how in each case they were condemned by false witnesses and false judges. Then proceeding to praise John Huss, who had been condemned to be burnt, he called him a good man, just and holy, unworthy of such a death, saying that he himself was prepared to go to any punishment whatsoever. He said that Huss had never held any opinions hostile to the Church of God, but only against the abuses of the clergy, against their pride, their arrogance, and the pomp of prelates. He displayed the greatest cleverness, for when his speech was often interrupted with various disturbances, he left no one unscathed, but turned trenchantly upon his accusers, and forced them to blush or be still. For 340 days, he lay in the bottom of a foul, dark tower. He himself did not complain of the harshness of his treatment, but expressed his wonder that such inhumanity could be shown him. In the dungeon, he said, he had not only no facility for reading, but none for seeing. He stood there fearless and unterrified, not alone despising death, but seeking it, so that you would have said he was another Cato. O man worthy of the everlasting memory of men, I praise not that which he advanced, if anything contrary to the institutions of the church, but I admire his learning, his eloquence, his persuasiveness of speech, his adroitness in reply. Persevering in his errors, he went to his fate with joyful and willing countenance, for he feared not the fire nor any kind of torture or death. When the executioners wished to start the fire behind his back that he might not see it, he said, 'Come here and light the fire in front of me. If I'd been afraid of it, I should never have come to this place.' In this way, a man worthy, except in respect of faith, was burnt. He said, Socrates did not drink the poison as willingly as he accepted his flame. And another man of somewhat similar character, who some years later became Pope himself, but was then called Aeneas Sylvius, bore similar testimony to the way that Jerome had stood. It's interesting that this Aeneas Sylvius later became Pope Pius II. We'll mention him later. And when people quoted statements Aeneas Sylvius had made, he'd say, don't pay any attention to anything Aeneas Sylvius had said, that it's only what Pius says that's infallible. He quite reversed his views when he became Pope. But in this translation that I quoted here from Shaw, last year I read from a different book that had a little more quotes, the letter. Here there are little dots every now and then, and just about every case where there's a little dot. He said, I don't mean to defend anything in this man that is contrary to what the church says. Now, I don't mean to say that it was wrong to kill him. I don't enter into such matters. That's quite outside of my error of judgment. You see the attitude he took. Let the church make the decisions it wants. I won't oppose it on anything. I'm just admiring the man as a clever man and as a brave man. So, and I imagine if he hadn't had all those little statements in, his letter would have been burnt probably before we ever would have been able to see a copy of it. But it's a very interesting picture of the two types of men, the light, witty humanist and the earnest, courageous Christian. But Huss was burned, and Jerome of Prague was burned, and Wycliffe and both of them were strongly condemned by the council, but this did not
end the problem, it did keep it from spreading into Europe much, and in the rest of Europe. And after the council was over, they organized what they called crusades against the Hussites, which attacked Bohemia and tried to put them down by force and failed to do so. So in 1431, they gave up the attempt to conquer by force, and a new council at that time, which we'll look at later, welcomed a group of Hussites to come and to present their case before them to try to get a unity with them. And they made certain concessions. They gave them the right in their country to have the laity drink of the wine as well as the bread and various things like that, which detached a certain portion from the rest. And eventually, however, the Hussites continued in control of most of Czechoslovakia until 1621. And in 1621, the very year when the Pilgrims landed in America, in that year, the Austrian Empire emperor succeeded. There was, at that time, a very fanatical man succeeded in gaining control of Czechoslovakia. He killed a great number of the leaders, and they hunted out the copies of the Bible and destroyed them. And the Hussite attitude, which had been characteristic of nearly all the people of the country, was wiped out. As the Bible was forbidden, the people were forced to go to the churches, so that 50 years ago, 95% of the people were fairly ardent Romans in Czechoslovakia. But about 15 years ago, when the communists took over Czechoslovakia, and Jan Masaryk, the foreign minister, was either thrown from the window or jumped from the window because of his opposition to the communist takeover, they found on his table, where he'd been reading it just before his death, a copy of one of the Hussite Bibles, which his ancestors had kept in the family for over 200 years when it was death to even have one, and had read secretly. And so there were those who kept alive the faith in that country through all these centuries, even though it was forbidden and condemned. And then after a brief period of freedom, the country has again now passed under the iron heel of a different despotism, one equally tyrannical and equally cruel. Well, the problem of heresy then, you can say that the council took very vigorous measures, and probably many would feel they were successful, because the contagion of Wycliffeism in England was almost wiped out in a period of a century. It took many burnings, many killings to do it, but it was practically wiped out before the Reformation. And while it was not wiped out from Czechoslovakia for a period of 200 years, yet it was kept into that region, and the rest of Europe was given a fear of the Hussites that continued to such an extent that people in Germany would fear, they would scare their children by saying the Hussites are coming. And there is a popular song which they were singing when I was there as a student. I went to the town of Naumburg, and they had there a popular song which began, "The Hussites came against Naumburg with 100,000 men." It was a great exaggeration, but the Hussites did make some counterattacks which guaranteed their safety for about 200 years. Well, we'll look next at what the council did about the city. So number five, the council's actions regarding the schism. The council's actions, that is regarding the papacy, of course. The council's actions regarding, let's call it the papacy. The council's actions regarding the papacy. Under that, we'll call A, John the 23rd. Well, John the 23rd promised in the strongest language that he would abdicate if he was asked to by the council, that he would do what the council wanted. But he was hoping the council would continue him as pope, and he saw how the council was moving against it. Nobody there had much respect for him, because they knew about his early life as a pirate. They knew about the wickedness and licentiousness of his life. And somebody got out a number of copies of a statement describing the life of John the 23rd before he had become pope, and accusing him of just about every crime you can think of. Of the crimes of wicked uncleanness almost beyond description, and crimes of murder and all sorts of things. And this was distributed rather widely. And John began to fear that something would be done to depose him as Pope. And the council began to fear, suppose that John declares, I am the Pope, I'm going to move the council from Constance down to Rome or some other place where he'd have more control over it. Or suppose he declares, I now dissolve the council. Would people continue to attend the council and to work for the objective of solving the schism? And so they demanded that he promise he would never do either of these two things. And he made a great public declaration. He would never stop the council till the members of it were ready to. He would never leave the place without giving full notice of it. And after he gave this notice, one day when they were having a big festivity over something, he disguised himself as a groom and driving a wagon, he passed out through the gate and left the city. And of course the people were in confusion. He went over into Austria, where the local prince was a good friend of his, and tried to protect him. And they had quite a time of uncertainty about this, but eventually his protectors decided not to protect him anymore, and they sent a group to escort him back to the council. And then they took action, deposing him, naming maybe a third of the crimes of which he was accused, but still a terrible indictment it was of anyone claiming any position. And they deposed him as a pope, but they made him a cardinal. And first he was in prison for a time. Then eventually they made him a cardinal and gave him a good position in the church, but he died before he'd been there very long. So that took care of the first of these, but we'll have to wait till tomorrow to see what was done about the other.